The time now, 8:30. Saturday Night Theatre.
As I came through the streets, people looked at me in a kind of astonishment, I think, that I should be here at all, where they are. A man put his hand out, as if to touch me, then drew back in a suddenly remembered fear. And I thought, he sees me differently. But it is a difference we share. We share only what separates us. Arms, legs, a head that seeks each other out. All of this we both have. Yet they are used to claim each other as distinct. Do you see? I was told you were a holy man. I wanted to speak with you.
How long since you have come to India?
Almost a year. I am attached to the military administration.
Who are you?
My name is Langston. Roderick Langston.
That is what you are called. Who are you?
I'm not sure.
That is why you have come to see me. Because you are not sure. Where are we, Roderick Langston?
This is Amritsar.
Amritsar, a play by Colin Hayden Evans, with Frederick Treves as Brigadier General Dyer, T.P. McKenna as Sir Michael O'Dwyer, and Saeed Jaffrey as the Guru.
Amritsar.
A letter, dear, by the second post. I'm sorry, were you sleeping? It's addressed General R.E.H. Dyer, the Mal...
Letter?
I'll leave it on the bed. You can read it later.
I don't want to read it.
You will later. You need to sleep.
I was thinking, remembering... duty. My God, how weary time makes it sound. Is that what the letter says, eh?
Would you like something warm to drink? Milk, perhaps?
A soldier's duty is nothing beyond that. You see, it is not duty toward something. It is duty itself. Am I dying, Elena? Elena?
Yes.
Good. Now I shall know whether I was right.
Where did you get it?
A soldier. They sell such things.
And the money, from where?
I did not buy it with money.
It is said that the royal families of Germany and Great Britain shared the same blood. Now they tell their people to drop bombs on each other. It is another way of sharing blood, perhaps. There was ammunition for the revolver.
Here. We should leave this place to them. I feel it strongly.
Raining. Up and down the street, always it is raining. You forget why I came here?
I do not, but I think...
You forget. Otherwise, why do you wish me to leave?
What is my age, Geeta?
You are 35 years.
15 years, son, on that day. It seems longer. Yet 20 years is not long. 1919, April 13th of that year. You remember, Geeta? Should I break my pledge then?
No.
No, I should not. A boy only. I lay beneath the bodies that night, some still moving, like waves. That day I had seen some pictures in a book at the school, the sea. They are like waves. That is how I thought. There were cries always, as animals. When people are dying slowly, they sound as animals. Death puts sounds in their throats that the talk of all their lives cannot say. It was a night of such sounds. This soldier, he was English?
He spoke as if it were so.
Your mother was there that night, Geeta.
It is said she was only a little hurt, but she would not leave. She stayed through the night. Who can say why? In the morning, too much of her blood had gone. They will take your blood too, Udan.
This Caxton Hall. I can walk.
They will not let you see him.
I am Indian. Sir Michael O'Dwyer is British. Will a father refuse to see his son? Did he not once govern a whole nation of his children, keeping us safe? Wasn't it so? How many British did we see in the square that day? At Amritsar, Geeta, must I carry the name for you? Perhaps three, less even. I remember the General Dyer. It was a distance, and I could not see his face, but I remember him. He walked so very slowly, behind the men with guns. Dyer then, old Dwyer now. Each man must have his day, Geeta. It is the way of things. It was Indians that held the guns, British guns. Ordered by our father, Sir Michael, that we should be better protected.
What will you say?
Say? What is there to say?
You have heard how the court has offered him the chance to speak in his own defense. In effect, he said nothing. A man has been murdered, and the perpetrator of that crime has nothing to say. We are left then with the facts alone, which, it may well be thought, offer the most eloquent explanation of all. The defendant, Udham Singh, would have us believe that the crime of which he stands accused was an act of revenge for an incident that occurred in his native land over 20 years ago. He speaks of a massacre where the official history records only the legitimate pursuit of law. He speaks of Sir Michael O'Dwyer, his tragic victim, as the true cause of the unfortunate event, when Sir Michael's contribution to the eventual freedom of the Indian continent has long since been internationally acknowledged. It is my duty then, and my only duty, members of the jury, to summarize for you the facts that have brought this man, this Udham Singh, to the dock of this Old Bailey court. The date, I have no doubt, is now well fixed in your mind, the evening of March 12th, this same year, 1940. And in the Tudor Room at the Caxton Hall, where 180 people had gathered that evening to enjoy a lecture. As we have heard, Sir Michael O'Dwyer had made a short speech and had taken his seat beside the other invited guests on the platform. What follows next is not in dispute. The defendant, Udham Singh, approached the front of the room, drew a revolver from the inside of his jacket, and fired six shots in rapid succession. We now know that two of those shots fatally wounded someone.
I have heard the evidence against you, and it but remains my duty, beyond any question, to concur with the decision of the jury and pronounce the sentence upon you as prescribed by law. Udan Singh, you will be taken from this court and then to a place of execution.
You think so little of us, the Europeans. We have brought you many advantages. There are schools now.
There are. You give them slates and chalk, and on them they learn to write the names that later they must allow you to own. There are some who say it is a high price to pay for literacy. They would wonder if a dying man might feel better for knowing he could read the doctor's report.
Why do you talk so much of dying?
It is something that Indians understand.
We mean well.
We have heard it said most often. It is true, Roderick Langston. It is what the British do best, even if they do not know why they do it. You rescue donkeys too, do you not? Your women? I have seen it. From a life of hardship, it is said. But to the donkey, the weight it must carry is only a weight. It is the onlooker who sees it as a burden. India has her weight to carry, sir. So too your country. There are burdens only when each tries to lift the one belonging to the other.
All the world's problems are a result of man leaving his own backyard.
Oh, Gandhi?
Pascal.
Ah, but he was French, you see. Fond of home, the French.
In Hindi, you feel it might suffer in translation?
The letter is dated March the 9th.
In the year of our Lord, 1919. Even the calendar conforms to the chosen religion of empire.
The governor wishes to imply no disrespect for the religious element that has crept into what is more obviously an overt political persuasion. You see?
What am I to see, Commissioner?
Kitchener. We can speak frankly, I hope.
Another British president?
I ask you here informally. I would have thought that set the tone of the path the administration wishes to pursue.
Man does not live by administration alone. The Indian especially so. That seems to be the problem, does it not?
If I may say so, the problem is civil disobedience. As a lawyer, you will appreciate the term, I think.
Some hundreds of millions of Indian nationals disobeying a further 20-odd thousand foreign ruling class? That is what you mean, perhaps?
I mean a mere handful of the population being stirred into radical agitation by...
By fellows like me. Educated ones. We want our country back, Commissioner. You will not give it to us.
What are we to do?
Observe the law. We ask no more.
Your law?
Where none existed before.
And what law is it, sir, that makes it legal for an entire continent to pass out of the keeping of those born to it? There are those who feel you legislate against justice, Commissioner. Why did you ask me here? To your bungalow.
We do not mistrust each other. I think that can be said.
With respect, sir, that matters little. We do not sit in these very comfortable armchairs. They are not Indian, are they? We do not sit as two men.
Our voices belong elsewhere. You to your distant government, mine to the people with whom they feel they must deal. That is grounds for mistrust, I think, Commissioner. How else could it be?
It is the Indian mind, Kitchlu. It is shadows on the wall and blames only the sun, never the figure that blocks the light. I think you must stop these public meetings.
They are peaceful, Commissioner. Lawful.
However, that is not the effect they might produce. It is felt
I am afraid, Commissioner, that there is no discussion possible on the matter. I do not stand on a platform and invite others to gather round me. The people are already there. For the young ones, most of their lives. Do you not see this? They ask now only for a voice and will lend their strength to any that give them that. It matters little who it may be.
Regrettably, I cannot permit it.
And I, Commissioner, cannot stop it.
As Commissioner Irving, you acted entirely as I would have myself. I cannot think you need a better mandate. Or must the governor wash his own linen?
I think, Sir Michael, with respect, we are dealing here with a situation with which we are not entirely familiar. Kitchlu is...
And what difference is that to make, may I ask? Eh? Can you think that I have been free of their infernal schemes over the years? Have I not played with their Sir Michael O'Dwyer this, their Sir Michael O'Dwyer that? I am. You can believe that I am. But I don't discuss, you see. I don't argue. I use a word you'll not find in Foreign Office dictionaries, Irving. I say no. Thou shalt not unless I say so. I see I offend your professional diplomacy, Commissioner. Damn it, ruffle man. What do they do, these nationals, these lovers of their country, I'll tell you. They grumble off and return 6 months later with a new petition about their demands. The point in question, you see, Irving, is that they can do nothing else. What alternative is there? More signatures on a piece of paper, is it? If so, it requires us only to extend the courtesy of saying it has been read. No more. The Indian has not understood overnight. I remember well, a couple of years back now, when the Middlesex regiment joined us fresh from home. They'd lost a lot of Verdun, might have been Ypres. Veterans, anyway. However, they didn't know the Indian, you see. The sergeant put in his requisitions that he was back at Catterick. The stores are run by this little native chap. He's small, but very efficient. Ran the whole thing as if his life depended on it. Oh, he was most indignant. We have Cadigans for male sex. We have Cadigans for female sex. We have no Cadigans for middle sex. You see, they asked for democracy like a fish might ask for the freedom of the fields. No, they are safer in their river. It has flowed too long for change. Democracy in India will be nothing but a sham. Kitchlu will not be the last, however. Even here. It was discreet.
Well, the car already contained what personal belongings were necessary. It was waiting outside my bungalow. I thought it better he didn't return home.
Oh, quite. He will have gone quietly. They do, you know. Our Secretary of State is rather shocked at learning that Indian children are not admitted to the Boy Scouts.
Lord Montague has the benefits of Westminster, sir. It confines India to a box of cabinet papers.
No flies in the box, Irving.
It's said Lloyd George feels safe with him.
Only another way of saying he jumps when he's told.
A permanent fixture, then?
You may speak your mind, Irving.
Montague seeks reform.
Certainly. And will do a splendid job of convincing all and sundry he represents official British policy on the matter. Why else would the PM appoint him Secretary of State?
The native population will take him at his word.
Would the policy work if they did not? Irving, the future of this country lies with its past. The man behind the plow, the ox who pulls it. Let him leave the fields. Let him speak with a voice not his own. And what do? Free him, is it? I wonder. My own feeling is that such a way can only bring him low. I tell you, I love this land too dearly to stand by and see it happen.
But you can't.
Do you hear such talk of self-determination in the fields? Do you hear it? No. It is the talk of books alone and those who read them.
But there is Gandhi.
Gandhi, that unctuous hypocrite. It's said he sleeps with young girls, virgins, to test his damn purity.
It's also said they stay virgins, sir, which may well prove his point.
You take him seriously?
I take seriously the mood of the people. They're behind the man in increasing numbers. The actual worth of his stand under such circumstances seems quite secondary.
That's true enough, of course. In terms of administration, it matters not a jot what people believe, only how many of them actually bother.
Mm.
I suppose the fact that Montagu praises the man, sufficient cause to consider him dangerous. Our Secretary of State has a faculty for unwittingly pinpointing, if not an exactly rotting apple, at least one that is most seriously overripe. No, Gandhi's soul force, as he calls it, will be met with fist force if I have anything to do with it. Let it dare threaten the administration.
With respect, sir, it dares very soon, I think. There are already talks of strikes. The public meetings are becoming more inflammatory. Kitchener's removal has not been met exactly with enthusiasm on the street.
Then they will hear what we have to say at the dinner this evening. They will hear. And the government of this province is and will remain determined that public order, which was maintained so successfully during time of war, shall not be disturbed in the time of peace. Action has therefore been taken under the Defense of India Act against certain individuals, both at Lahore and Amritsar, who, whatever their motives, were openly endeavoring to rouse public feeling against the government. The British government, which has crushed foreign foes and quelled internal rebellion, could afford to despise these agitations. But it has a duty of protection, both to the young and ignorant, whom they might incite to mischief and arouse while themselves standing aside. I therefore take this opportunity of warning all who are connected with political movements in the province that they will be held responsible for the proper conduct of meetings which they organize. The legal administration is here by right of our own moral superiority and the will of Providence. These alone constitute our charter of government. The recent puerile demonstrations against the Rowlatt Act in both Lahore and Amritsar would be ludicrous if they did not indicate how easily the ignorant and credulous can be misled. Those who want only to mislead carry a serious responsibility. Those who appeal to ignorance rather than to reason have a day of reckoning for them.
It can be explained?
Sir Sidney Rowlatt is a judge. The act is named after him.
What does it do, this act?
It preserves peace. The Indian might see it differently. It has to be said they do, in fact.
It is perhaps a law that sometimes says, listen, sirs, for the moment there will be no law at all.
We have different gods, you and I, and so different lives if we are to remain faithful to them.
Faithful all can stay. Only names are different. Like the heads which make them. Whatever a man, Roderick Langston, God, is the best thing he can do with himself. Forgetting that, he turns to making law.
What's that?
Damned if I can hear.
It's Eleanor, Harry. Open your eyes.
Oh, God this, God that. The whole country, is it? What's the point, then?
You let the milk get cold.
Who said that?
Harry. It's Eleanor.
I know that. What's that, Brown? Oh. Eleanor. Yes.
What did you do with the letter?
I don't know.
We'll find it later. Would you like me to read to you?
No.
Which book would you prefer?
Something short.
Small.
Yes. I would have taken it through. Too small, you see. Rain. Narrow. I could have...
Walter Scott, then.
Narrow. I couldn't get through, you see.
Some are asking where it will all end, Commissioner. It occurs to me the more appropriate question might well be, why did it begin in the first place?
It seems...
I have always considered the use of the term free speech a complete misnomer. One pays dearly for everything one says, and seldom, in my view, ever sees a profit. A child should not seek independence from the parent until it is of age. Is that not so, Commissioner?
But it is a
matter. Else the parent would be thought, rightfully, in my view, entirely irresponsible for letting it go.
It has to be said, coming of age is traditionally a topic on which parents and children rarely seem to agree.
Hence the need for education, Commissioner. Do you see any about you in the mail? It has to be said, I do not. What on earth do you think that woman is doing with that brass gong? Is she a collector, or what you say? No, it has to be said, I do not. Not a scrap of it. And can the uneducated govern? It is a question I continually ask.
They would argue, I think, that it is not Western government they need.
And what other kind is there? Worthy of the name, that is. Are we to sit around endlessly listening to an increasingly violent rhetoric, and that in a language quite foreign to our own? Is that fair, Commissioner?
I think it is safe to leave it in the administration's hands, Mrs. Hardinger. Do not anticipate the present unrest will continue for much longer. Steps have already been taken.
She has detached the gong from the framework, Commissioner. Huh? She's holding it up to the light. Will she strike it, do you think? Perhaps our attention is required.
What? Speak up.
It's nearly time, dear. Nearly time.
It was difficult for me to get away. The riots. Had I to pass through the town, I could not have come. They're attacking Europeans on sight. Women, even. One had been taken to hospital, badly beaten. Do you not care? You seem so indifferent.
If, when asleep, Roderick Langston, you dream of countless starving people, are they less real to you than those you see when in the waking state? Do you not feel the same pity, the same will to help? Yet from where did these dream people come? Were they waiting for you to fall asleep so that they may appear? Or, as must be true, were they simply given life by the mistaken belief that the dream itself was real? Having spent the sleeping hours in the presence of such suffering, should you, upon waking in the morning, rush to organize relief? Surely not. You are awake, and the people are no more. In the same way, liberation brings the morning of the waking dream.
Please seat yourself, Dyer.
Commissioner?
Now, we interrupted a dinner party, I understand.
I wish my sincere thanks.
Well, at least you'll not be detained with social niceties here. You were fully briefed at Jolanda.
I was told of the rioting and ordered to bring a company of men here without delay.
Mm. I'd better bring you up to date. It has to be said, the city is virtually in a state of siege. The mob have total control of the native quarter. Many European businesses, even banks, have been looted.
Mm.
Now, this seems to have satisfied them for the moment, which will explain the probable calm you met when coming through the street. But I think it not unduly pessimistic to view this as merely the lull before the full storm. The temporary absence of violence cannot be taken as a true indication of their mood.
That is my view also, sir. As we marched through the streets, we were spat upon. It is not a treatment familiar to the British soldier.
You'll have heard that the telegraph wires have been cut.
It was apparent as we entered the city.
Mm. Your orders, then?
They're perfectly clear. To wrest power from the mob and return the city to order. I have 1,200 men available, including cooks, orderlies, and servants.
Adequate, would you say?
I've always felt, Commissioner, that the right determination circumvents mere adequacy. I have already taken the liberty of issuing a proclamation warning the inhabitants that if any acts of further violence are committed against property or person, it is to be taken for granted that such acts will be construed as incitement and punished according to military law. I have included all public meetings in that category. The aim, therefore, will be to clear the streets and keep them clear. I have always believed in an 11th commandment for the native, thou shalt not agitate. I mean to see it enforced, Commissioner.
Yes. Well, that...
The women are at the fort.
Well, they came in yesterday.
Ah.
Many could only get through by dressing as Indians.
Mm. There is also the matter of a Miss Sherwood. Beaten, I understand. In the streets.
Escaped narrowly with her life. Mm. Shocking business. Every effort's being made to apprehend the culprits.
Yes. With respect, sir, I feel that to be a largely futile exercise.
Hmm?
It would be more to the point to assume a collective guilt, I think. This kind of incident demands a most definite example to be made. I have ordered natives to be taken from the streets near where the beating took place. At random, they will be publicly flogged.
I see.
You approve of the measure?
For how long? How long do you anticipate?
Until I am no longer angry.
Doesn't require my approval. Your orders give you full responsibility here, do they not? Well, you've already covered much ground, General. My only worry is that it may well be used by others later, in which to bury us all.
At the Jolly and Waller Bog, sir. Later this afternoon, it said.
By whom is it said?
Street talk mainly, sir. It's usually reliable.
All proclamations were posted?
By noon yesterday.
What is the size of this meeting?
Difficult to estimate, sir. Upwards of 10,000, possibly. It's a religious festival, you see. The population has swelled, rather.
Where's Sir Miles? The Commissioner, where is he now?
Sir Miles is asleep, sir. The train of the past...
I want a small force, immediately, Red Hill. No more than 100. Use only Gurkhas and Sikhs.
Yes, sir.
You carry it to the front. You are a water carrier, Uda. Take it to the front.
There are too many. Others will be tested here.
I shall not say it anymore.
Hey, let the boy rest. The years will bring him more work than he can know.
The police almost sit on our shoulders. There are so many.
see. They look on us even from the skies. Should I get the policeman water?
You should not.
What do they do now?
Leaving! Over there, look! They leave!
But why?
They go to the tent. It is peaceful. They can't only. They will have water and you will see.
But they all go. Like it's both guns in front. Sorry, Bunker. Have I not said so?
Oh, it's not a sad time. They will see that not all of us is peaceful. It's sticks in our hands. They will see.
Give the order, Red Hill.
Water, Gita. Will it help you? Gita, there is water. I can bring you more if you wish it. I did not take it to the front as you asked. I entered
the jail in Awalabag by a very narrow lane, which necessitated leaving my armored cars behind. I saw a dense crowd, estimated at about 15,000. A man on a raised platform addressing an audience and making gesticulations with his hands. I realized that my force was small, and to hesitate might induce attack. I immediately opened fire and dispersed the mob. I estimated that between 200 and 300 were killed. My party fired 1,650 rounds. I returned to my headquarters at about 1,800 hours. At 2,200 hours, accompanied by a force, I visited all my pickets and marched through the city in order to make sure that my order, as to inhabitants not being out of their houses after 2,000 hours, had been obeyed. The city was absolutely quiet, and not a soul was to be seen. I returned to my headquarters at midnight. The inhabitants have been asked to bury their dead in accordance with my orders. This I am allowing. Signed, R.E.H. Dyer, Brigadier in General, commanding 45th Brigade.
Your report received and the action taken, both correct and approved by the Lieutenant Governor.
I am not likely to forget it. Good God, man, I said. I am Mrs. Harding. Do you not remember how we reduced your wife's duties during her last confinement? And unlimited vegetables? Has all this somehow passed you by? He pulled himself up to his full height, looking me in the eye. They're not tall, as you know, but I hadn't seen it before. And I confess there was a momentary alarm. Madam, he said, if you are kind to us much more, we shall not have any blood left at all. I said to him, whatever the rights and wrongs of the situation, and I for one rely entirely on the appointed administration to determine which they are, I shall never consider to be harangued with some folklore in my own servants' quarters in any way appropriate. He left, as they do, without a further word. We have eaten coal for the remainder of the week.
There's a great deal to be said for regarding the walking horse as a largely ceremonial form of transport. General Dyer feels we should make a show of it. Parade the victory, as it were. I feel we should. Dyer, as it turned out, tended to agree. You know, it may be put down to either a good conscience or a callous one, but it is a fact that public cares never lost the half an hour's sleep. Not so you. Hey, Irving. Slept very soundly, I hear, through the whole thing.
I was not informed, sir. Dyer took the entire matter into his own hands.
He was obeying orders. I would think it a little odd if it had been seen otherwise. I feel it better if London be kept, well, shall we say, vague on the matter. I would prefer all reports to originate with my office. That is clear?
Yes, sir.
The fact that native troops we use always helps, of course. It would almost be a matter of policy, in fact. The impression... Why is there fire beyond the railway there? Smoke?
It's a funeral pyre, sir. They're still burning the dead.
It is the ritual that holds this country in harness. They spread the death of a few hundred poor souls over the course of a week to prolong a grieving best forgot.
I think were it only a few hundred, sir, the fires would have been left low after the first day.
It will be necessary to put Kitchrow on trial, among others.
If you recall, Governor, Kitchrow was deported several weeks before the disturbances. Martial law wasn't declared until April the 14th. He was not in the city at that time.
Was he not responsible for the unrest? Irving, I put it to you, is Kitchrow innocent in these matters?
I refer only to the law of the matter, of course.
We are the law. I have backdated the declaration of martial law to March the 30th. I see no reason why he should escape the net.
I came here with hopes, I suppose. It seemed that way. I served in France. I was wounded in 1916. Back in England, I found myself behind a desk. I can't think why. When you give up caring for your life, others seem to see that as an opportunity to... well, to try to live it for you. Do you know what I mean? I felt like that when I came to India. Hope, I mean. It was like going to France all over again.
And once again, you have been wounded.
Why do I always come to see you?
For your own sake, why else?
Must everything always be for our own sake? Can we never do something just for others?
It is depending on which self you choose, Roderick Langston. What you truly are can never cause another harm. What you believe yourself to be can do nothing else.
I don't understand.
Understanding would send you home again.
to another desk, perhaps. Understanding is the wound from which you are never healed.
It was felt the matter best dealt with personally, Governor. I was instructed to hand over the documents to you alone.
Casson, you say?
Matthew Casson.
Foreign Office.
The last 8 years. I enjoy my duties, Governor.
It is apparent, Mr. Casson. What has Hunter to do with all this?
It was felt that Lord Hunter would be the most suitable choice to head the committee of inquiry.
Well, obviously, man. Otherwise, the fellow wouldn't be spewing his Cotswold guts all over the Bay of Biscay at this moment. What I'm asking is, what's his bag? Do you always stare like that, Mr. Casson? Is that how they instruct diplomats these days?
I'm sorry, Governor, I meant no offense.
You meant nothing at all, which is worse. Yes, I can see my problem with you is going to be your neutrality. I shall be looking for a man to talk to frankly and getting nothing back except a code to which only Whitehall has the key. Is there a cipher in there, Mr. Casson, would you say? Behind that rather fine waistcoat, it would save us both a great deal of time if I were to know now.
I'm a professional messenger, Sir Michael. Neither I nor my mission, if I may say so, need ever require you to exert your curiosity beyond that point.
So be it. To business. First, your party piece. Then my telling you the thing can't be done, only to end with you knowing all the while that the decision has already been taken. Let the opera commence, Mr. Casson.
It has to be said, there is great pressure in Parliament for an official inquiry, Governor.
An inquiry into what?
Governor, the whole of the Punjab is under martial law. Yet London has received little or no elucidation as to why you consider such a drastic step necessary. At best, there's talk of revolt.
There was revolt. It was put down.
It's felt that it might have been accomplished rather more appropriately.
Amritsar.
Unavoidable, perhaps. But nevertheless, unfortunate.
Which, in diplomatic parlance, I take to mean an eventual accountability. Is that, then, to be the nature of this inquiry, Mr. Casson? Perhaps you have already the findings in your pocket. Can Lord Hunter be vomiting his way down the sea lanes for nothing? It would pain me to think so.
The Viceroy has suggested such an inquiry be relentless in coming to the truth. Could anyone wish more? Or fear less?
What do you know of India, Mr. Casson?
Oh, you are aware this is my first visit, Governor.
What then of your first impression?
Has to be said, it lacks any immediate appeal. I'm speaking personally, of course.
It lacks civilization? Culture?
Yes, I think that an accurate assessment.
And we are here to impose that very thing, are we not?
Some might suggest example, a better method than imposition, I think.
Invariably, those who make a single visit only.
Sir Michael, it sometimes happens that the problems of a provincial administration and those of central government can, well, appear to diverge, shall we say. Not so much through a lack of common motive, but perhaps through a forgotten need to appear to differ.
You will tell me why, of course.
Well, to quell social unease, surely. To present an appropriate face. In the instance under consideration, if the Indian feels that London is not entirely unsympathetic to his claim for independence, he'll more willingly abide by the current situation. Unlawfulness is no more than a disguised dissatisfaction, after all.
And dissatisfaction is cured only by giving them what they want, Mr. Casson, which, in the instance under consideration, is India herself.
Giving or appearing to give. The effect is not dissimilar, though the difference may be entire.
It doesn't work that way, I'm afraid. More's the pity.
It worked in Arabia rather well, I thought. Not even our erstwhile Arab man Lawrence had any real doubts as to what was to finally happen in Damascus.
The moral being never to believe what you read in the newspapers, eh?
As now, Governor.
This is theory, Casson.
With mere persuasion, you need to spread your load over several generations, and even then there's no guarantee. Social unease? I have none. Not in the Punjab. Made it illegal a long time ago and intend keeping it that way.
Rhetoric works only when people listen.
When they don't, it is to the law one must turn, and that forcibly.
Governor, I don't wish to overemphasize the weight of the proposed inquiry. The government, after all, will soon approve a bill of indemnity. All officers will be protected against any possible legal recrimination.
There was a time when such things might well have been taken for granted, Mr. Casson.
It's part of my brief, Governor, to inform you that London feels that such times may well have had their day.
My dear Eleanor, as I write, my health shows some improvement. And since returning from the hills, I am not plagued with the same mad headaches once my lot. You will have heard, perhaps, through the newspapers, that we are to have a committee of inquiry into precisely why a soldier should be obliged to do his duty in the service of law and order. The matter is clear, of course. But nevertheless, it has to be seen as a subject for investigation. I'm glad to hear there is so much popular support for the action amongst the European community. I sometimes feel the name Dyer is fast becoming a condemnation for all that happened on that day. I have no fear for the outcome, of course, but the formalities that must be observed in reaching that end are, it has to be said, becoming increasingly tedious.
Please be seated, General Dyer. Now, you are aware of the terms of this inquiry and of your right to appoint counsel on your own behalf, which I understand you've declined.
I have, sir.
Well, the committee proposes to inquire specifically into the events that took place on April the 14th at the Jallianwala Bagh in Amritsar. They are the events over which you had sole authority. That is so, is it not?
My orders gave me full responsibility for initiating what action I saw fit, yes, sir.
We have heard other witnesses state that the meeting that day was entirely peaceful, that no person in the square was armed, and that there had been no attempt to attack your own forces. Would you care to refute any of that evidence?
The meeting was in flagrant disregard of the proclamation issued by the authorities the previous day, and therefore illegal.
But presumably you knew of the gathering prior to its formation. Some 15,000 people were involved, after all. Why did you not attempt to stop the meeting assembling?
I was certainly of the feeling that I had done quite enough to deter any such meeting taking place. It was only when I heard that my orders had been defied that I took a small force to the spot in order to uphold the ruling.
Or did you order the gathering to disperse at that time?
My mind was made up as I came along in my motor car. If my orders were not obeyed, I would fire immediately. As soon as we opened firing, the crowd began to disperse.
Why then did you not stop firing at that point, if your object was to disperse the crowd?
It was my opinion that had I limited the fire, the effect would not have been sufficient to justify firing at all.
You are saying, therefore, that it was necessary to fire in order to disperse the crowd?
I am saying it produced the desired effect. It may have been possible to disperse them without firing. It's difficult to ascertain.
Did you try?
It would have taken time. They would have returned later, which would have made us all look foolish. I think it must be said that we were faced with a situation that had all the appearances of a widespread revolt, and that not solely confined to Amritsar. The city was effectively cut off. We had to act alone, and that decisively. What took place, I consider nothing less than duty.
May I interject, sir? This committee would know your own estimate of the casualties involved, both dead and wounded.
I estimate the dead at 300, and the wounded considerably more.
How have you arrived at these figures, please?
I divided the total rounds fired by five. May have been six, I can't recall exactly.
You would therefore dispute a figure of over 1,000 dead?
I consider that improbable.
The wounded were left in the square throughout that day and the following night. Why was that, sir?
It was not a military matter to tend the wounded.
And those who crept back to the square later under cover of dark, many looking for relatives, sons and husbands who had not returned home, they did so in defiance of an official curfew, did they not?
It is not uncommon, under martial law, for a curfew to be established during the hours of darkness.
But such a curfew, sir, effectively prevented anyone tending the wounded during those hours. You may wish to elaborate, sir.
No, I don't think so.
I am asking how it is possible to establish law that denies wounded and dying people medical treatment. That is what I'm saying.
It's awfully difficult, you know, to afford legal protection to those who refuse to honour its precepts. Only the law-abiding have the right to protection, surely. Perfectly fair setup, I would have thought.
How many children were killed in the square, General Dyer? How many did you shoot?
I don't know.
But you feel that they did not deserve the protection of the law, is that it?
The presence of the innocent seems, at least to me, merely to reinforce the guilt of those who encouraged them there in the first place. In an action of this kind, it must surely be clear that it would be totally impracticable to discriminate between the two.
Impracticable, General Dyer. Yes. You toured the city that night?
There was complete calm. The streets were empty.
You visited the Jallianwala Bagh?
No.
Had you done so and found those people tending the wounded, what, sir, would have been your action?
Clearly the curfew would have been broken.
I asked, what would have been your action?
I would have issued orders for their arrest.
Let us be clear, sir. You would have arrested wives, sons, husbands who were attending their dying families. This is what you are saying?
I am saying, simply, that I would have enforced the law.
Yet with respect, Mr. Chand, we are here to inquire into what did happen rather than what might have occurred. I would appreciate it greatly if the members of the committee confined questions to the actual events of that day.
The motives of this man, Lord Chairman, seem to me at least to be very much part of such happenings.
I have noted your remarks, Mr. Chand.
What I am saying is that this bill of indemnity, sir, says an officer cannot be held legally responsible for his actions if carried out in good faith. It is motive, then, with which we are surely concerned here.
As I say, it has been entered in the record, Mr. Chand. I would like now to turn to the matter of the public floggings. These were ordered by you, General Dyer. You erected wooden frames in the streets, especially for the purpose, did you not? The bystanders were forced to watch.
All such platforms were dismantled. I cannot recall anyone being whipped on one.
Yet you had them erected for that purpose.
It was not due to me. They went unused. I was ordered not to. I would remind the committee we were dealing with a situation that resulted in a woman, a white woman, being severely beaten, almost to her death. I was searching my brain for a suitable punishment to meet this awful case.
Was this when you effectively closed the lane in which it had happened?
The pickets were posted at both ends, yes.
And all Indians had to crawl down the lane to gain access to the houses. Sometimes at bayonet point, I understand.
Our civilization regards womanhood as something sacred, I think. I felt that lane should be marked out as an infringement of that sacredness. Therefore, I told the pickets that no Indians were to pass, except on all fours. It never entered my mind that any sensible or sane man, under these conditions, would intentionally go through that street.
Will the general tell us how people who lived in the street were supposed to carry on their normal business? Will he tell us, please?
They would have to wait until the pickets were removed. I think some inconvenience of this kind not entirely inappropriate under the circumstances.
The pickets left only when the nighttime curfew began. Anyone leaving the lane at such times would be liable to be shot. You felt perhaps there was a further alternative, General?
They could have used their back entrances.
There are no back entrances in that street, sir.
Am I to answer all this? Could they not have gone over the rooftops, perhaps? There is a general furtiveness about the native that makes him come and go very quickly. I cannot see the difficulty.
Sir, you will...
It was quite by chance, was it not, that Miss Sherwood's attackers had been in the lane at that time? They did not frequent it usually.
Originally, when I first learned of the attack, I had erected a platform in the middle of the street. And when I had those men who had beaten Miss Sherwood, I wanted to lash them there. I wanted to keep the street sacred, you see. It was important to me. Therefore, I did not want anyone to pass through it. It was an accident that those men had to crawl there.
He spoke proudly, did he not, Commissioner? I do not see it as merely quaint that a man should equate womanhood with sacredness. It may well be a trifle idiosyncratic to do so publicly, of course, but that must be a matter for the individual concerned. Are we never, Paul? The man sits his horse like a lardy cake. Drive, man, drive! It has to be said, polo ponies do not travel well, Commissioner. I believe it directly attributable to the general unreliability of the railway system.
Dyer is a man of honor, Mrs. Harding. And I think the committee are convinced of that fact. It will determine the outcome.
My uncle used to feed them tea, you know. Four times daily, more when it rained. There was a small fire kept going in the stables for the brewing. Those who disliked it had it poured down them. Yes, it was a lesson I cherished, Commissioner. As in ponies, so in life. Those who don't like it should have it poured down. Save a lot of committees a great deal of trouble, as I see it.
I think we must return to this matter of why no warning was issued for the gathering to disperse. Had you perhaps considered that your own small force might be attacked, General?
The situation was very serious, certainly. I'd made up my mind that I would do all men to death if they were going to continue the meeting.
You were going to do them all to death, sir?
I have said so.
But they had not attacked you. Your men were in no danger. Were the lives of some 15,000 men, women, and children to be forfeited so easily?
I think we must know that, General.
The appropriateness of the punishment, as with all matters pertaining to a state of martial law, is a matter for the officer in charge.
You are saying, sir, that all civil law, its codes and practices, had been effectively abolished?
I would say suspended.
Can we ask why you ordered your men to direct the firing at those places where the crowd was at its thickest, at congested exits from the square, even at the windows of buildings from which others watched?
Your reports seem better than mine.
Mine were written in blood, sir.
Does that conclude your line of questioning for the present, Mr. Chan?
It does not. It does not, Lord Chairman. With your permission.
Mm-hmm.
General Dyer, your orders on coming to Amritsar were simply to relieve Commissioner Irving of responsibility in the restoration of order in the city. That is my understanding. Did you consider yourself competent to undertake such a task?
Certainly.
A confidence you still feel?
Nothing has occurred to alter that opinion.
At the Jallianwala Bagh that afternoon, I understand your original plan had been to use heavier arms in the dispersal of the crowd. Armored cars. But the passage was too narrow. If the passage had been sufficient to allow an entrance for the vehicles, would you have opened fire with the machine guns?
I think probably, yes.
With a predictable increase in the number of casualties.
Or a faster dispersal of the crowd. It depends how you look at it, really.
You had the soldiers fire on people that were lying down.
I doubt that. There were far more visible targets available.
And there were no measures to help the wounded?
No, certainly not. It was not my job. The hospitals were open and the medical officers were there. They had only to apply for help.
The few that did so, sir, were taken into custody for attending an illegal meeting.
You are simply saying, are you not, that the law was properly enforced? It is something we should all be very glad to hear, I would think.
I do not know what is important anymore.
What is this important?
What matters? Personally.
It matters, then, only because it is personal. You believe your opinions true because you have them. And you have them only because you believe them true. Is there any other way they can exist at all? I do not think so. They are only a way of giving life to the ideas you have about yourself. Sir, can what is really true ever change?
It does. All the time. Life changes.
The way of looking at it changes. That is true. But what is real must always be the same.
That is how we differ, you see. You have such a disregard for the appearance of things. I can never accept that.
Two children play in the sand, sir. One builds a temple, the other a cave. The ignorant say, how grand this temple! A cave is such a pitiful thing beside it. But the wise smile. They know that even though the shapes may differ, and the belief in them sometimes change also, all is ever sand.
General Hudson, you are Adjutant General for the British troops in India.
For all troops in India.
Yes. May the committee ask your opinion on the event pertaining to the Jallianwala Bagh?
I'm not clear as to the question.
You feel that the action was justified?
Such incidents must be judged purely by the results they obtain. Insofar as there had been an immediate halt to the troubles, it would have to be considered justified, yes.
Supposing, instead of firing on the mob and killing several hundred people, General Dyer had bombarded the city and killed, say, 10,000, would not the same results have followed? Simply because there were no further disturbances, would you conclude that the act was justified?
It is a matter each commander would need to consider for himself.
But under military law, I understand that the end always justifies the means.
I am afraid that is the position the world over. There is no external authority concerning the matter of martial law.
Therefore, in General Dyer's case, it might be said, for all practical purposes, that he was really acting half as commissioner and half as general. But how can that be, legally speaking?
That would be only one way of expressing it, I think. It could equally be said that the definition of martial law is that it tends to suspend any definition.
It does what it wishes.
What is necessary at the time? General Dyer would be considered as acting commissioner because he was administering the law of the district.
By suspending the law?
If you wish. technically speaking, nothing can be considered as strictly legal under martial law. That was why it was necessary to introduce a bill of indemnity.
Which legally absolves officers from the consequences of any military act they see as fitting.
They remain responsible for all acts not committed in good faith.
And who shall know if the officer acted in good faith, General?
He would. And he would be asked as much as an officer and a gentleman.
You must excuse me, sir. I did not realize such officers would be questioned so stringently.
But as governor of the state, Sir Michael, are we not to assume you were fully aware of any dissident movement at work?
It is the substance of my evidence, sir, that just such dissidents were at work, hence the actions we were forced to take.
What I am inquiring into is why the assumption was first made that there was a revolutionary movement. Is it not surprising, for instance, that such a movement made no attempt to arm themselves?
Such people do not always reason far ahead. I think their first object was undoubtedly to paralyze government with the tactic of so-called passive resistance. That is to say, to withhold supplies, boycott Europeans, conduct strikes of government employees, and perhaps to refuse payment of taxes, that sort of thing.
Are you saying, then, that interfering with the actions of government through civil disobedience and an attempt to completely overthrow such administration by violent means are to be considered the same action?
Well, the implication is obvious, I would think. With respect, it is very easy for those not familiar with this country to be misled by this general talk of pacifism. In my view, and not solely my own, I might add, this is a thinly disguised attempt at anarchy. Now, if that doctrine is taken on here, the intelligentsia will disappear, and the government with it.
Can we return, then, to the matter of Amritsar itself? You gave General Dyer written approval of his actions after the event?
That is correct.
On the basis that he had quelled a potential rebellion. On what did you base that assumption?
If you mean proofs, I have none. But I am strongly inclined to believe that it did exist.
Well, let us assume, then, that it did, for the moment. Wasn't it foolhardy, even ridiculous, that no attempt had been made by these people to obtain arms?
I think they were counting on other factors, on the spread of disorder by subverting both troops and police, and perhaps getting the immigrants on their side.
But, sir, we have it on the evidence of General Dyer himself that he could have dispersed the gathering without firing.
I can only say, then, that the general must be a very sanguine man.
He won't, in my view.
Why should he? He spoke frankly, I thought. He has no occasion to retract.
Others might see that as opportunity, sir. The fact that the suggested knighthood was quashed.
Rightly, as I see it. Oh, we're doing it a bit.
My feeling is that Whitehall sharpening her knives.
And they're rarely blunt. How else would she cope with the boils on the backside of democracy, hmm?
There is the matter of the National Congress inquiry.
The deniers fall to me. It need not concern you, Irving.
I have been mentioned, sir. I feel...
You wish to answer the charge that we plotted what took place at the square?
I suppose I wish to know if we did, sir. They say they have evidence, written evidence, that the Indian who organized the meeting was in touch with the police throughout the day. That he left the platform and the square a minute before the shooting began at a signal from an aeroplane. They claim the plot had been constructed at a meeting in Lahore, attended by several leading figures, Indian and European. The outcome of the meeting, it is said, was to acquaint you with the plan and urge its early implementation. Is it true?
You wish to lay the ghost of your own conscience.
It is my right to know.
You'll be absurd, man. Your rights are traded back and fore as the commodities they really are, as with all men. We are administrators, Irving. We allow freedoms only to the degree that they enable us to impose greater controls. As a consequence, our principles need to be correspondingly greater. How else would they accommodate the broader view? What you are suggesting, thinking, is mere sand in the machine.
I am asking you only what the committee did not. Is it true we put those people all together in the square that day in order to...
That is the business of committees, Irving. To avoid the need to ever ask what is true.
Familiarity should, I suppose, be the measure of acceptance.
It is the one thing India can always promise you, Mr. Casson. An unendurable summer climate. Orange juice.
Ah, thank you. Last year seemed cooler.
A subterfuge of memory. The Foreign Office's stock in trade.
It seems every educated man in this country now knows the name of Lord Hunter, at least.
As an enemy of succinctness, perhaps. Three volumes is an awful lot of words, even by London standards.
They don't make exactly satisfactory reading, Governor.
The Indian Congress seem happy enough.
At the cost of the government's face.
Did London ever believe it could win both ways?
It's the wish of any government to at least appear to do so.
Twaddle.
But the ruling twaddle, sir.
Tell me, before we are forced to enter the undergrowth of diplomacy, are we to discuss the rolling of heads here?
I have a letter from the Viceroy in my case. It exonerates you completely. It felt that you acted with decision in a time of great difficulty.
To be frank, I had already permitted myself a certain... benefit of the doubt concerning my own position.
Now, I was referring... It's understood that General Dyer's health has deteriorated over the past few months.
He suffers from devotion to duty. It might be considered a pity that the complaint was not contagious.
It's felt that it would be appropriate were he relieved of his command and sent him on sick leave.
On what grounds?
On the grounds of his ill health. He'd be retired early. We have to anticipate events, Governor. If it should ever be necessary to dismiss him from service, there would follow a necessary forfeiture of both pension and military decorations. Now, no one would wish that, surely.
It would worry you to see that, would it, Mr. Casson?
Sir Michael, it's as well you know that London is in full possession of the opinions of the Indian Congress concerning what took place at Amritsar. In your position... I thank God it has not reached the ears of Parliament. Not that it's ever likely to. If justice were to be done over this matter, all those concerned would need to be broken.
What a very grubby profession you inhabit, Casson. Well, it has to be said he did himself scant justice, Dyer. Tell the truth, after all.
Always an exaggeration of required facts, in my experience.
So, once again, we are to sink to depths in order to preserve the appearance of doing otherwise.
How else are the heights to be made to seem a virtue?
Letter. What letter?
I shall read it.
From London? From London, is it?
Looks quite official. Oh, no, it's handwritten. How extraordinary. No name or address.
Oh.
A message, I suppose. Oh, no, there is a name on the back. A Mr. Udham Singh.
Sounds like a brand.
Rather elegant hand. A greeting of sorts, I imagine, in the way they have. Harry, did you know Mr. Udham Singh?
Is it time for my soup?
Well, anyway, he says...
Secretary of State for India. What does that mean anymore, cousin?
Well, I suspect, Sir Edward, it means that your job will be safe for quite some time to come. Who else would want it?
As I thought O'Dwyer was an outside.
Well, he seemed to grasp the matter very ably, I thought. It was probably a mistake to have left him with the Viceroy's letter, absolving him from all possible blame.
Oh, he jumped too quickly. O'Dwyer would publicly challenge his right to a peerage after privately selling his mother to gain it. He's drumming up support for our sacrificial general in a way that cannot be entirely ignored, unfortunately.
I understand one of the newspapers has organized a national appeal for Dyer.
Yes. He's already called at the India office and asked for an opportunity to state his case. He'll appear before the Army Council, which will back him to a man, of course.
But I thought the general was ill, sir. Confined to bed, I heard.
Doesn't stop him popping about. You worry, those India types, you know. Always were. Anyway, it seems he in no way feels disgraced. Not at all. More maligned. Which is why many of the committee members are baying for more blood. What good is the scapegoat if its bleeding has not seemed to be done? Yeah. Particularly by the goat itself.
Well, I have completed the legal review, as you suggested, sir, but it has to be said I have serious doubts as to any advantage to be gained.
Don't ask me for a waltz, Casson. Just get on with it.
Sir. Well, it is clear that under the India Penal Code, Dyer will be indictable for culpable homicide.
Murder, you mean?
His intention was to cause death. For a European, the sentence would be penal servitude, though frankly I doubt if anyone could make that stick. On the other hand, there is the possibility of a private prosecution, but then he would presumably find protection through the indemnity bill.
Cannot the matter be approached militarily? What is the position concerning a court-martial?
He was obeying orders, sir.
Written orders?
Which are still in his possession. He could be tried in England. After all, he is now resident. Detention under the Fugitive Offenders Act would be possible, but such a prosecution would entail trial by jury, and public opinion being what it is, I doubt if any English jury would convict him.
The saviour of India, according to the Mail. What, then? Exercise your deviousness, cousin?
Well, in my view, sir, any legal course would lead to acquittal. He'd then be in a very strong position to demand reinstatement, even some form of public apology. However, it would mean the government would effectively be seen to be repudiating the Hunter Committee findings, which might well, of course, lead to other facts emerging.
Quite. Problem, of course, is the damn Army Council. They'll see it Dyer's way. Any one of them would have done the same thing, after all. Well, it's down to Churchill, then. He's to see the military before the council sits. If he can't swing it, no one can.
Why, though? Why? Always why. Always it is why. What is anything beyond the thinking about it? Is it the intent or the axe that cuts a tree? Would an axe be dangerous without an accomplice? What fills the mind fills the world. Why is yourself, Roderick Langston? I have respect for what you say, but I believe you to be wrong. The world cannot live as you see it. Does it live so well now? The way it sees it? Because one man may believe another wrong, does he then take over his life in order that it should be made right? The best
the British could ever do in India would be to make it more and more British. What else could they do? What a man has, he always considers best. They could never make it the best of what it is to be India. No one would expect that of them. And so never is it offered. So the life and hope of your country are simply one way of putting words together. The life of India, another. When words stop, where is the difference? You want always to give me words that make a question, which means I must give you others that make an answer. Between them, they make a country only of the mind, in which the truth is made to wander and get lost. It is a game that, once tiring of the playing, makes one man dream of another's downfall.
I wish I could understand.
No. The man who wishes understanding gains it. Like your world, Roderick Langston, you have set yourself firmly against understanding.
Parliament, Harry. A majority vote in the House of Commons. A complete vindication. Even the Times. But it's a very long article. Perhaps later, when you've rested. It completely the letter. But I have done so, Harry. I've read it to you several... Very well. It's from a Mr. Udham Singh. Yes. Well, then, a little saying, probably. He says, I was only to carry water.
In Amritsar by Colin Hayden Evans, General Dyer was played by Frederick Treves, Sir Michael O'Dwyer by T.P. McKenna, and The Guru by Saeed Jaffrey. Cornelius Garrett played Langston, Renu Setna, Udham Singh, David Bisoni, Udham Singh as a boy, Shireen Shah, Geeta, Zia Mohadin, Dr. Kitchlu, Gabriel Wolfe, Commissioner Irving, Michael Drew, the prosecuting counsel, Garard Green, Lord Hunter, June Barry, Mrs. Harding, Peggy Ann Wood, Eleanor Dyer, Sam Dastor, Ratan Chand, John Rye, Matthew Casson, Jack Watson, General Hudson, and Paul Nicholson, Sir Edwin Montague. Amritsar was directed in Bristol by Sean McLaughlin.